I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. While I was writing this introduction to today's show, my radio was on, my laptop and desktop computers were on and pinging at me, my cell phone was at my side, and I struggled to resist the urge to check if I had any new messages, and I did. Such is the world of technology and distractions that most of us live with. No wonder we feel so overwhelmed with so many demands on our attention. Our guest neuroscientist, Amishi Jha, has been researching attention ever since she was a stressed-out young mother, juggling work and family, and realizing how hard it was to be in the moment, to be present, to pay attention. She found mindfulness enormously helpful, which started her on a path to understand the mechanics of how attention works, using brain imaging studies. She writes in her new book, Peak Mind, Think of Attention as a Flashlight. Amishi Jha is a professor of psychology and director of contemplative neuroscience at the University of Miami and joins us once again on Radio Times. Amishi Jha, nice to have you back.
So great to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can join us during the hour. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions for you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call at 1-888-477-9499. You know, since the pandemic continues to dominate our lives, I want to begin there. Help us understand how the stresses, even the demands of COVID, have affected our ability to pay attention.
Yes, I absolutely wholeheartedly agree. I can hear from the sigh in your voice that you're feeling
that. Here we go again, right?
Well, here's the kind of surprising part for me. I'll just start from kind of my own journey with the pandemic. For the last 15 to 20 years, I've been studying the impact of high stress circumstances. So circumstances that we'd characterize as volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And this VUCA is essentially an acronym that's used quite often by a lot of my military colleagues, VUCA. And we learned a lot about the impact of those kind of circumstances on various professions, including military service members. And the news was never good. Right. If you are in an enduring period where volatility, uncertainty, et cetera, are prominent, your attention will decline. And it ends up that attention really fuels almost everything we do, from our ability to think and make decisions, sound rational choices, from our ability to regulate our emotions and even connect with other people. So we had been studying this already. And then, like you said, the pandemic came around and I realized that, wow, essentially at the global scale, we are all in a VUCA period. And what we are experiencing, cognitive fog, dysregulation, uncertainty, anxiety, et cetera. Unfortunately, I'll have to say, this is exactly what would be predicted based on everything we knew from the research we had done. Living through it is obviously a very different thing than understanding it from the, you know, scholarly point of view. But I wanted to just start by saying that the experience that we all had, it wasn't really a figment of our imagination. It really was the consequences of those types of circumstances on how the brain will function.
Well, and just to add to what you just said there, you talk about, you know, what is kryptonite, the three major forces that degrade our attention: stress, our mood, and threat, which really underscores the VUCA that you referred to.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, stress in this case, because stress can be very beneficial. I mean, in some sense, there's something called eustress, put the letters E and U in front of the word stress. That's activating stress. That's like saying, okay, I've got a report due next week. I better get on it. It's the right amount of challenge. What we're talking about, and what I mean by kryptonite when it comes to the word stress, is distress, that our demands, our challenges, outpace our capacity to meet those challenges. And then we're in a very uncomfortable situation where things can start spinning in a way that does not feel like we're any more capable. And in fact, it drives down these core cognitive resources of attention so we can fully meet any challenge.
Well, help us understand, and this is a very basic question, but I think it, you know, I want to make sure we're all on the same page. So what exactly is attention? I mean, what is our brain doing when we are paying attention?
Yeah. I mean, I think that this This is a really great question to ask because we throw around that term a lot and we usually are complaining about our attention. I haven't heard many people use that word where they're like, oh, my attention is awesome. Usually
right.
we're begrudging the fact that we can't quite pay attention. And I love the picture you painted of you even sitting there trying to write the intro. I mean, we're full of stimuli and challenges in our moment-to-moment lives. Attention, though, is actually a success story of human evolution. And if you think about what life would be like without attention, we'd kind of be in this kind of fog or kind of blankness or kind of a cacophony where there'd be so much we couldn't make sense of any of it at all. And it, through the course of evolution, really developed to solve a big problem that the brain had, which is that there was far more information out there in the world than the brain could fully process. And if you try to understand that the purpose to understand what's out there is to engage and interact and reproduce and do all those things that, you know, living beings want to do. So the solution to this problem of overwhelm and overload for information processing was attention. And that the broadest level, attention is the ability to advantage or privilege some information over other information.
A kind of bias, as you write.
Exactly. It is a type of bias. Now, bias, obviously, we don't have a lot of good connotations. We have a lot of bias about the term bias. Here, I'm just talking really sort of, I guess, even plainly that it's advantaging some things over others. And you mentioned that term flashlight at the outset. That's a really handy way to understand one aspect of this bias, that we can actually, just like an actual flashlight, direct our attention. And if we were in a darkened room, wherever it is that we directed that flashlight, we'd get privileged information of wherever it is that we're pointing to. And so the bias would be we advantage that information that's illuminated by the flashlight.
You also say, and this almost contradicts what you just said there, which is that our minds are also designed for distractibility, and that has also served us through evolution as a kind of vigilance, that we need to be aware of what's going on around us, and we can get distracted depending on what is calling to our attention.
Yeah, let me just take that step of the flashlight one tick further, because actually it'll relate back to that exact point. So if we were in a darkened room, or let's say a darkened path, you know, I remember my days in Philly going for walks in the evening, and sometimes I'd take a little flashlight with me just to walk down the sidewalk, make sure that the up and down, the ups
yes.
and downs are...
We know the sidewalks of Philly, yes, exactly.
Right. I actually dearly miss those Philly sidewalks, I'll tell you, after my decade in Miami. But we just want to get good information so that we don't, you know, trip ourselves up, frankly, just walking down the street. Now, if in that same moment I heard some kind of rustling behind me or, I don't know, some other loud noise, I would take that flashlight and whip it back to where I heard the sound. Same exact resource, this mental resource of our attention, with this metaphor of a flashlight, but I would direct it in the context of understanding what this something that alarmed me or potentially threatened me, what it was. So that's what I'm talking about, that we can direct our attention. And by the way, there's other ways that we pay attention beyond the flashlight, but just to go with that for a second,
sure.
We can willfully direct our flashlight to where we want it, just like when I was walking, you know, down this darkened path. But attention can get yanked. The flashlight can get yanked. And it can get yanked by physical things in our environment, things that are potentially advantaging our evolutionary survival, right? If there's something threatening or even novel, self-related. I mean, the list of all the things that we might privilege or automatically orient to. If you were walking down the street and somebody just called out, Marty, for sure your head would go toward where you heard the sound.
Right.
We privilege some information. But that's what I mean. The distractibility is essentially there because if we were so focused and so able to fixate on certain content that we disregarded everything else in our environment, if you go back to our evolutionary ancestors, they would have been eaten or they wouldn't have noticed a storm coming. So there has to be some pliability and for the flashlight, so to speak, to be yanked around by things that really could matter and be consequential for survival.
Well, let me pick up on that yanking idea that you mentioned there and talk about, you know, the gadgets. I mentioned all the gadgets that, you know, many of us have surrounding us, whether at work or at home, that are yanking on our attention. In fact, in many ways, they are designed through algorithms to demand our attention. So how does that make it difficult then for us? And we're not talking about, you know, a lion about to attack us. We're just hearing a beep coming from a machine.
Right. And as you just mentioned, we're not hearing a soothing harp sound.
No, we're not.
Just
we're saying something that says, you know, pick me up, pick me up, pick me up.
Pick me up. Pay attention to me. And so, yes, you're absolutely right that a lot of the modern context with our gadgets, our social media alerts, our news feeds, the design emphasizes and capitalizes on these aspects of our mind. And if you look at the kinds of things that do grab us, it is things that are potentially threatening, fear-inducing, novel, bright, shiny things, loud sounds, unusual things that come up, and a whole other set of things that are really in this realm of self-related stuff that will override, in many ways, in many circumstances, where we want to put our attention. So just you and I'm thinking back to your beautiful, the picture that you kind of painted us. You're sitting there, you're on your computer screen, you want to type something out, and then you hear a ding on your phone. And at that point, essentially, if you probably weren't writing about attention, you might have even, without thinking, picked up your phone, looked at the text. Maybe you're holding your phone. I don't want to read too much into your habits, Marty. But you might have even clicked on another app while you're on your phone, or you know, I wanted to check if this restaurant has maybe outdoor seating today. So we do this all the time. We do it without really thinking, and all that initiated was a sound that you heard. So what happens now? Now you want to get back to the task at hand. You've got to overcome the engagement you have in whatever you're doing on your phone to get back to put the flashlight back on the screen to finish the writing that you're doing. And this is essentially putting us in an exhausting mode where we're constantly having to task switch. And the thing that's pulling us away, in this case, was our technology.
Well, we're almost up on a break here. You mentioned the word task switch. And one of the things that you say in this book is that there really is no such thing as multitasking. We're not doing two things at the same time. We're toggling back and forth between various tasks and probably not doing them as well as we could if we paid just attention to one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think multitasking as a term is frankly a myth. When the tasks that you want to simultaneously or that you think you're simultaneously performing require your attention at all. So, you know, probably if you're expert at walking and talking and walking and thinking are not going to be a problem. But if I put you on the edge of a cliff and now say, okay, just maneuver your walk down this, you know, very thin ridge, and now talk to me about something, it would become a lot more challenging because you're trying to distribute your attention that way. So yes, absolutely. What we end up doing is not multitasking, but task switching. And just like this scenario we described of you're on your phone and then you're back at your computer, it is exhausting.
Well, we have to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is neuroscientist Amishi Jha, and she's got a new book. It's called Peak Mind. She's also a professor of psychology, director of contemplative neuroscience at the University of Miami. Already lots of comments coming in. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with neuroscientist Amishi Jha about attention and distractibility and why there are significant benefits to paying attention in our highly distractible world. Let me just pick up on one thing, and then we do have some comments here that are germane to what we are talking about. Thinking of all the devices that are designed to get our attention, I think for most of us, you know, we have to figure out how to learn to live with these devices. We're not going to toss them out the window. We need them for work. We need them for, you know, many, many parts of our lives. So what do we do about that?
Absolutely. And that is essentially one of the big points I make and that I think is important to make right now. It's unreasonable to say they're just too much. We're just going to throw them out the window.
Yeah.
We cannot break up with our phone, frankly. I mean, in some sense, our digital life is a type of food that we need. We cannot simply not have it. And frankly, the other thing I was going to say is the mandate that you might put on yourself to break up with your phone is not only unreasonable, but probably not going to be effective. Right. So we need to relate to our technology in a different way. And I actually want to connect this back to something that we talked about a few moments ago regarding what distracts us, right? So we talked about you're walking down the street, you have a flashlight pointed to where you want to go, and then you hear some kind of rustling and you yank the flashlight to wherever you think the sound is coming from. Now, that's for the external environment. And in some sense, the ding of your phone or a notification does the same thing. It pulls your attention away. But even if you had no distractions in the external environment, your attention may still get pulled away just as ballistically by a thought you have. So if you're just sitting there and you think, oh my goodness, did I unplug my whatever electrical device? That alarm generated by your own mind is going to be a significant source of distraction that probably will pull you away from whatever you're doing. And, you know, you can go back to even medieval monks that talk about leaving all of their worldly possessions to go devote their lives to God. Them complaining, you know, I'm in my monastery, my job is to pray, that's what I want to do, yet I can't stop thinking about lunch. So this problem of a constant tension between where we want the mind to be, and then unbeknownst to us, our mind is no longer there, is in some sense an ancient problem tied to this design of the brain.
Well,
and again, it's not a flaw of brain design. It is a success story of human evolution. But sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. And I was thinking of, and I do want to get to some comments here, but just to kind of complete the thought here, one of the things that you have found and that you write about in this book is mindfulness, which is, you know, paying attention to these thoughts, but also a regimen of breathing and of sort of being trying to be, I've tried this stuff. It's really hard. I'm trying to be in the moment, right?
Yes. Maybe I could just say a couple words about mindfulness, because all of this feels a little gloom and doom. Like, oh my goodness, our brains have been like this for thousands of years, and what are we going to do? And it still feels terrible, and I haven't really given any solutions to what to do if you can't break up with your phone. But I want to say that really my motivation for even writing the book in the first place was because I felt like we had enough data in our own hands from many years of research and working with very high stress groups like those that I described at the top of our time together. You know, military service members, first responders, medical and nursing professionals for whom stress-related challenges and feeling highly distractible are part of their professional life. They're part of the normal circumstances. What we found in working with them is that practicing mindfulness meditation training, and we can unpack what that is, for as little as 12 to 15 minutes a day, staved off the downside of this distractibility. Their attention did not degrade. It actually stayed stable over time. Their mood didn't decline, even if it was a very high stress circumstance, and they experienced less insurmountable or distressing emotions. So there are solutions. And frankly, even though you know, in my kind of history, I was at the University of Pennsylvania. A lot of this work started while I was there, right at the beginning of our conflicts with Afghanistan and Iraq, where military service members were deployed time and time again. And it seemed like an impossible circumstance to help a group of people who had to still go back and do another tour. But we were finding that this was beneficial. So I wanted to offer this to all of us, because especially through the pandemic, but frankly, in our lives, stress, threat, poor mood, these things that we call kryptonite conditions, they're unavoidable as human beings. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what mindfulness is and how to incorporate it in. But I think that I just wanted to say that there are solutions that are effective, not just from my opinion, but from research study after research study.
And it's, I think, a little challenging to talk about mindfulness on the radio, because you almost need to see it to understand it. But it is a kind of way of breathing and thinking, I guess, and paying attention. That, and I've tried it, and I have to say, using myself as an example, I find it really hard to keep all those thoughts and things away. Well, and I find myself, frankly, fighting with myself to try to calm down. Yeah, no, go ahead. I know you want to say something.
Can I address that? Because actually, it's not related to breathing, and it's not related to thinking.
Okay, fair enough.
And I want to just kind of normalize something. The fact that your mind is generating at a feverish pace a lot of thoughts is a sign of your humanity. If you're a human being, your mind will wander. 50% of our waking moments, our attention is not in the task at hand. And that's the baseline. That is normal. That is healthy. That is selected for. Now, when we experience high stress circumstances, that number can tick up and it can become quite problematic. So first of all, it's to just normalize it. There's nothing wrong with your brain, not you in particular, Marty, but any of our brains, really, when it comes to the flood of thoughts that appear. So that's normal. Okay. The thing that is important to think about with mindfulness is that it, and let me just define it, because then we can, at least I can speak about it on my terms from the research we've done. So mindfulness is a mental mode. It's an intrinsic capacity of all of our minds. And it has to do with paying attention to our present moment experience without editorializing or reacting to it. So in some sense, we are attending to our moment-to-moment experience to get the raw data, not a story about what is happening. So in that sense, it's not about thinking. It's about actually seeing what is moment by moment. And yes, it can be challenging, but a lot of the challenges, I think we can at least reframe our experience with them so they're not quite as challenging. So can I just give one little quick example?
Sure,
and we can
please
go
do.
To the comments. So let's go back to just a very simple, and I understand why you said it has to do with breathing, because the reason breathing comes up a lot and people think mindfulness is about breathing is that it's a handy target for our attention. I have a practice in the book called the Find Your Flashlight practice.
Right.
And I call it that because it's not about, you know, make your attention unmoving. It's find your flashlight. The flashlight is this metaphor of attention as this capacity to focus, to privilege some information over other information. So the instruction would be, and, you know, people can do this for as little as 30 seconds to get started and then work up to about 12 minutes a day. Pay attention, sit in a comfortable, quiet place, you know, really advantage yourself in any kind of way that you would if you were going to do a physical workout. You'd put on the right clothes, you'd have the right atmosphere, right equipment, sit in a quiet, comfortable place, lower or close your eyes if that's comfortable for you, and then notice yourself breathing. Just that's the first instruction. You're sitting, breathing. Most of us, we've been breathing this whole time, have not been paying attention. If we weren't, we'd have bigger problems. So thankfully that's happening. And this is why it's so handy. We don't have to pay attention in order to breathe. It is already there for us. So in a very inconspicuous fashion, we can take that flashlight of attention, and the formal practice begins by us saying, okay, find something prominent in your sensory experience tied to breathing. Coolness of air moving in and out of your nostrils, or maybe your chest moving up or down. This is a very non-mystical thing. It's so ordinary. You're just taking that flashlight and directing it towards some specific set of breath-related sensations. And that's your intention. Put the flashlight on those breath-related sensations. The next part of the instruction, and this is where it comes into what you were saying about the pain point of this practice. The next part of the instruction is, when you notice your attention has wandered away from that breath-related sensation, so noticing, that's a win. You noticed it. You found your flashlight. Aha, it's not at the breath. So focusing, noticing, third part of the instruction, when you notice your mind has wandered away from these breath-related sensations, simply redirect it back to the breath. So in some ways, it's three steps: focus, notice, redirect. And in many ways, our military colleagues call this the mental push-up. We're just exercising it. We're not getting into a conversation about why does my mind wander so much. It's normal. It happens. The win that you want to emphasize, and that's what I meant by the reframe, is, I noticed it. That's cool. I can just bring it right back. And, you know, we're not doing this to become Olympic-level breath followers. We're doing this because when we're sitting in front of our computer and the ding of the phone happens or a thought pops into our head, we can say, flashlight's not where it needs to be. Redirect it back.
Just that simple. Amishi Jha is our guest today on Radio Time. She's a neuroscientist. She's also the author of a new book we've been talking about called Peak mind. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We got several comments here about gadgets. I'm not surprised about that. Kyle says, I found that working remotely from a company based in Georgia was not a good fit due to the constant need to be on email, on phone, messenger apps, travel, etc. I made the decision that it was time to move on and reclaim my time. I start a new position in my area soon, just finding it was just too hard to work remotely for all the reasons that Kyle listed. ER says the worst culprits for distraction are coworkers. I work in zones. When I get into the zone, I'm 100% more productive. The moment I get that ding or ping, it feels like a freight train in my head coming to a halt. It will take me 20 minutes to get back into the zone. And then ER says, tell our bosses. Let me add one more thing. Mobile phones have a switch that turns off all sounds. Just use it. I was wondering about that, just picking up on what Stu said there, Amishija. We can keep our devices, just turn them off.
You know, that's the basic point. I mean, I think there's so many great concepts that were just topics that were just brought up. So the first thing is, yes, we need to shift our cultural understanding that requiring people to be in a multitasking, and I put that in quotes, environment, is not productive. It is not productive in terms of time. People are more likely to make errors. Their mood will definitely degrade. And it's just not going to get you the kind of performance that you want from yourself. So the simple instruction is, yes, monotask instead of multitask. So that means willfully decide. And of course, all of us can't do this all the time. But when you can, do it. Turn off the notifications. Let other people know for the next, 30 minutes, I'm going to be in an uninterrupted moment. I will not be answering your calls. You can set as much as is possible for you, set the parameters so it advantages monotasking. And also realize when you set up the time to monotask, you still have that internal distractibility to deal with. Be aware of it. So, so think of the last time you were trying to read a book by yourself alone, maybe in nature somewhere, not really anything external, but you might get to the bottom of the page and have no idea what you just read. Amen. So know that not only do we have to deal with the external distractibility, we have the internal distractibility as well, but do your best to advantage monotasking. And we do need to start promoting a culture change around that.
You know, I think for some people doing the thing that you described about mindfulness can bring up some upsetting, disturbing, even traumatic memories. How do you deal with that, and how should we understand that?
Well, absolutely. And I would say, let's even before we go to trauma, because for sure you want to take seriously anything that might touch on a clinical response being needed. But when we stop ourselves long enough to know what the contents of our mind are, oftentimes we'll find we're not so happy with what we're seeing, meaning it's kind of sometimes a rude wake-up call of how distracted we are or the recurring thoughts that are occurring in our mind. And I think this is another reason why mindfulness can become a very tricky thing for people to begin often. It's hard, that's the first thing they'll say, because my mind is racing, I can't clear my mind, which I hope now people understand that is not the intention. We accept that the mind will wander, and there is no hope, because it would be unreasonable and not really part of the human condition to remove thoughts. It's you work with them, you redirect when you can. But once you realize that the mind wanders, you start maybe even looking at the kinds of thoughts that are coming up, and they can be upsetting, troubling, or just knowing that you don't really have a handle on what's going on in the mind. And there are other tools in the suite of mindfulness practices to help us with that, so that when we're caught in ruminative loops or catastrophizing, we can actually work with this content. So I think that the broader umbrella would be to say mindfulness is not around instant happiness or bliss, which I think, unfortunately, when it's associated with a spa vacation or some kind of retreat that you might go on, it's thought of that way. Mindfulness for me, my point of view and my lab's point of view, is a cognitive training tool to give us a better handle on what is going on in our lives and in our minds moment by moment. And we do this so that we can make better choices. We can actually deliberate with more clarity because we're seeing what is happening. Now, if some memories come up and they are quite traumatic or surprising, I strongly encourage people to seek professional advice, and in fact, mindfulness-based approaches that involve cognitive therapy that are trauma-informed are very powerful and important ways that people can better support themselves if they want to go on a mindfulness journey, but they know that there's troubling content that comes up. But frankly, for all of us, even if we haven't experienced trauma that we're aware of, we might end up having a little bit of a wake-up call before we start understanding, actually, if I know where my mind is moment by moment, I'm noticing that I'm entering territories of my mind that are not supporting me, and I can make a different choice or orient to them in a different way. Eventually, we start learning that this does give us more of a sense of ease and okayness, much more than we ever thought was possible. Before we might have been introduced to this.
Well, and again, quoting from the book, and this is near the end of the book, where you talk about what mindfulness is not. I mean, it's not this blissful state. You write, having a peak mind means living fully in the face of everything we have to deal with as human beings, through stress and grief, through joy and tragedy.
Absolutely. And, you know, that I just wanted to say the term peak mind, oftentimes people kind of envision some kind of successory poster of woman on mountaintop, you know, achieves peak success. That is actually the exact opposite of what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the plain, everyday, moment-to-moment presence we can have, you know, and part of that means sometimes knowing I am filled with grief right now. I am filled with anger right now. Maybe don't press send on that email. Knowing ourselves and befriending ourselves and our own attention in a way that can advantage our ability to feel fulfilled and successful in our lives.
We're almost having a break here. You talk about 12 minutes. Can you do like 3 minutes to get started?
In fact, I encourage it. I encourage a slow ramp up. The 12-minute number, we can talk through how we came to that, but again, it came through multiple studies where we triangulated that it was the minimum effective dose. The more you do, the more you can benefit, but I wanted to figure out what the threshold was where we consistently saw benefits when people did this for about 4 weeks. So I think there are ways in which we can advantage ourselves by just yoking a short mindfulness practice to a daily habit. Begin, if you think you can do 4 minutes, do 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. If you think you can do 2 minutes, do 30 seconds. Just get yourself doing it so that you're comfortable with this notion of what it is. Focus, notice, redirect. Keep this non-judgmental, self-supportive orientation, curious orientation of what's going on, and then you can build up.
We are talking about mindfulness, about paying attention in a world of distractions with our guest, Amishi Jha, and she is professor of psychology at the University of Miami, director of contemplative neuroscience, author of this new book that we are talking about. It is called Peak Mind. Much more after the short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, our guest is neuroscientist Amishi Jha, and we're talking about attention and mindfulness, the center of her research. She writes in her new book, Peak Mind, about the ways to gain focus, why it's important for our health and well-being. She says that our minds are designed for distractibility. It's the modern world that's really the problem. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can always call that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Here are a couple more questions from our listeners. Denise says, how can mindfulness practices be used with a person with dementia? Can they be? Have you looked at that, Amishi Jha?
People are, you know, this is a very big field. And essentially at this point, which was very different than when I started this work at Penn in early 2000s, there's a proliferation of different topics where people are trying to see if mindfulness training can be helpful. Now, if we were going to offer this to somebody that has dementia, we'd have to really rethink how we're going to offer these practices. And the same way that if we're offering them to children, we might rethink it, or patients with ADD, attention deficit disorder. So catering it to the specific challenges of the person that you're training will really matter. I'll tell you about one study we did where it was in collaboration with colleagues at Emory, it was couples, and one of the people in the couple pair found out that they had dementia, that they essentially was at early stages of Alzheimer's. And so they offered mindfulness training to that both people and the couple. And what they found was that those that were actively experiencing this diagnosis and this disorder were not having it. They were not interested. They felt that closing their eyes and paying attention to the breath was not the right use of their remaining moments of awareness. But the person it really helped was the caregiver, the partner. And I think that that is, we see that over and over again. So there's studies done on parents with children with a significant physical and psychological challenges, and they're benefited. So, you know, I think that there's many ways in which we can offer it, and many studies now being done where it's designed for best practice in that context.
Here's an interesting comment from Cadence, who says, I think mindfulness is an innate quality that wanes as we become socialized. I think about all the years I work with children and babies and how zen it can be to hold a calm infant. I mean, children do seem to have, at least from the outside, this ability to you know, to pretend, to play with such, you know, with such zest and focus.
Absolutely. There's the quality of being in the present moment. You know, they're oftentimes in the here a lot, here and now, much more than we are. And frankly, this is tied to frontal lobe development. So children have smaller frontal lobes, and these develop and mature as we get older, where our frontal lobes are actually probably in peak form in our mid-20s, and we have a good 10 years where they're doing well, and then they start declining again. Yeah. So the front lobes are fantastic for all of these different systems of attention, including the flashlight and the other systems that exist. What they do allow us to do is mentally time travel. So now we can not just be in the here and now, which is an intrinsic quality of mind, but we can rewind the mind to the past to reflect on it, and we can fast forward the mind to the future. Now, the stronger we have the mental capacity to do that, probably the more often we do that and the more we default to that. So a lot of the reason may be because they cannot do this kind of mental time travel and reflective aspects quite as well. But there's another thing that looks a lot like, very childlike, but is quite different when it comes to mindfulness. So it's this not only this quality of being in the here and the now, but it's a quality of an awareness of what is occurring in the here and the now. So it's not just, you know, what is happening to my breath right now. It's that I am breathing. The coolness, the tightness, this itchiness on my face. I am aware as these things are transpiring. And this is something called meta-awareness. It's awareness of our awareness. That is a very important quality of our mind that is cultivated through mindfulness. And frankly, it's what we might call the monitoring function that allows us to say, aha, I notice I'm not on the task at hand. What is occurring right now? The current contents and processes active in my mind, which is what meta-awareness is, are indicating to me that I'm off task and I got to get back. So those features are not quite developed in children, but they certainly have the present moment, present-centeredness.
You know, thinking about awareness, I'm also thinking about, I think it's called highway hypnosis, the idea that if you, you know, you take a regular route every day, I'm thinking of people that commute down I-95 to Philadelphia. And I've done this, I think, on a road that where you just feel like it's so familiar, you almost, it feels like you are not thinking, that you are not paying attention. I've had that experience of saying, oh my God, how did I get home? I don't remember what I was thinking about. What do you make of that? What is going on there?
Remember what I mean, as you noted in the title of the book or in the kind of intro of the book, I talk about 50% of our waking moments we're missing, right? And those are the kinds of moments I'm talking about. You were certainly thinking, you were probably pondering and having a lot of important insights during that drive. What you were probably not doing is paying acute attention to your surroundings in that moment. And probably the road conditions were pretty stable. There was not a hailstorm happening. There wasn't excessive traffic. There weren't crazy drivers trying to cut you off, which is rare on 95. So good for you. And, you know, this allowed you the attentional bandwidth to expand and take that flashlight to turn it internal, so that you were now reflecting on past events or potentially planning. This can be very fruitful and generative. You were letting your mind wander on purpose in some sense, because there was no urgent need for you to devote all of your focus to the external environment. often if we do that and we're not aware of it, we may not gain a lot from the experience. If we can add a little bit of awareness, like this is happening, this is a fruitful, kind of joyful aspect of what my mind gets to do, it can be quite generative and actually even boost our mood a little bit.
Let me get Joe from, let me get Joe to join us on Radio Times. I'm not sure where you're from, Joe, but welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm from Philly. I'm in West Philly, or whatever they call it now with the gentrification. But anyway, I'm calling. First of all, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you for the topic. One of the things I wanted, and I'm listening because two things. One, anything to me can be a monotask. Right now I'm cooking and I'm focused on the, I'm listening to you, but I think what happens is people look for this special time to be present. But I think the key is to be present, whatever you're doing. That's why I said playing an instrument. But the other thing is I was telling the screener that I work with seniors teaching chair yoga. And we focus on the breath, not necessarily for longevity, but for them to understand that what they do in this moment will help the mortality and the quality of life. So we focus a lot on the breathing and being present and also encouraging them to use this as a tool in their everyday life when they're in the market and somebody with more than 15 items jumps in front of them, or even just simple things of walking down the street. Everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Yes, indeed.
But that's when I think we need these tools, to not think that you have to be in a special place, but to understand that the breath is always available to you and you can benefit from it. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, Joe, I'm really glad you called, and so interesting to do chair yoga. I mean, Shijia, what do you say back to Joe?
I'd say, keep doing it. I'm so happy to hear that you're working with seniors in this way. And I think you're absolutely right. In fact, like I said a little bit ago, the reason we take the time when we do to do focus on the breath is sort of a stillness practice. It's very similar to setting time aside to do an actual workout, right? Maybe deciding I'm going to be on the treadmill or go for a long walk, setting aside time separate from our lives to do it. But we're not doing it because it's intrinsically wonderful to do. You know, I just traveled for the first time after the long hiatus of the pandemic. And as I was putting my suitcase in the plane above the, you know, above the seat, the compartment above me, I was just having that thought of like, you know, I don't exercise my upper body so that, because it feels awesome. I do it so that in these moments, when it's a little bit of a heavy lift, I can do it. And in some sense, mindfulness is the same way. We're not, you know, at that moment, if I just dropped to the ground and started doing push-ups, that would not be very wise. But we practice daily, and I love the fact that you offer chair yoga as a very supportive thing, and mindfulness, of course, is introduced into many forms of yogic practice. We do it so that we can devote this mental capacity, this generalizable capacity, on demand in other moments of our lives, whether it's really enjoying cooking, whether it's really enjoying a conversation, or just taking a walk and taking it all in.
Is there any connection between aging and attention, or even memory? I realize that's a big, trifecta there. But is there a deterioration, or are memories stored in different places, or do we pay attention in a different kind of way?
You know, for sure, as we were talking about a moment ago, the frontal lobes, which are tied to multiple systems of attention and even something called working memory, they tend to, as part of normal aging, thin out a little bit. And the thinner they are, the frontal lobes are, the less kind of effective they can be. But I want to use this as an opportunity to make the connection between attention and memory, because it ends up that oftentimes the reason we don't remember information is not a memory problem per se, is that we were not paying attention to what was occurring to encode it into our memories. So if we are able to notice more and actually devote our attention to information, the chances of it being remembered will be greater. And it's interesting. I just had one of the episodes I describe in the book is a conversation with my wonderful mother-in-law, who she'd forgotten her shopping list. She was in a harried state driving to the supermarket. She was kind of trying to go through it in her mind. And she parked a car, walked inside, came back out, got in the car, and then realized her key didn't fit because she was in the wrong car.
Oh my gosh.
And of course, she was really concerned, like, oh no, what is happening to me? And what I described to her is, you know, she parked in this, her car was just two over from where she got in, and it was the same make and model. And I said, this was not a memory problem. I'm positive that you were so occupied in making sure you'd get everything on your list, you were rehearsing it. So now you weren't fully encoding, paying attention to where you parked exactly. And that's the only reason this happened. And by the way, it's quite normal. You know, usually the car was unlocked, so she was able to get in, but it's quite a normal thing. And we want to emphasize that the way in which we pay attention, which can change a little bit as we age, will actually benefit our memory, and to make sure we understand the link.
You know, I'm thinking of something. I think a lot of people feel this when you meet someone for the first time and you're introduced and they tell you their name, and within 5 seconds, you cannot remember their name. And I wonder, I mean, what are we paying attention to that we don't remember their name? And why don't we remember their name?
Right. Well, oh man, the list of all the reasons why we don't remember names I could go on about. But I think the main thing is that knowing that attention is going to be the glue will really matter. So that now you hear it, you actually encode it, you might repeat it to yourself multiple times. But if you're on to the conversation, if you're on to understanding something about who this person is, if you missed that moment to fully encode it, it may not stick.
Right.
And there's nothing sort of problematic about it. It's what happens when we don't encode information, we're not paying attention to it, it's not going to last. So I think that, think about the last time you were in a conversation and it's sort of a heated back and forth. You know, even right now, as we're talking back and forth, I'm saying things, you're registering them, you're holding them in your mind. You're probably having thoughts as I speak, but you're not blurting them out. You're waiting for the right moment. In that sense, you are juggling information that's coming in from your attention and your own mind's contents. Now, sometimes that internal content can take over. So now you're off to some other thing and you actually miss everything I'm saying. So we have to constantly be aware that there are multiple things going on, even if it seems like there's seemingly only one. And knowing that we can actually redirect our attention back to what the person in front of us is saying can be consequential. I mean, it could actually impact not just the quality of a relationship and communication in the moment, but for people like military leaders or judges or professors who are trying to communicate information and what they say matters in that moment. This is very important to be able to do that.
I'm also thinking, this is more about memory, about what happens when you hear a song, you know, a song from your teenage years or your childhood, and you're transported back to being that young person. What is going on there?
You know, it's very interesting because so many things can kind of pull us back in time. But the key that I think, as it relates to this topic of attention, is we are now not only transported in that feeling we get, but our brain is simulating a reality and kind of recreating a reality in time that is not tied to the present moment. We're immersed in that simulation. Such a wonderful and often powerful thing that our mind can do, especially if it's a fun song and a happy memory. But that same capacity to get pulled and hijacked, intentionally hijacked, to a displaced moment in time can cause a lot of problems. So now, if we were talking about trauma a moment ago, if you get pulled into a memory of the past and you're stuck looping on that, unlike the fun refrain of a song, that can be very problematic because we do need our attention in this moment to function, to think, feel, and connect, and we're now lost in the past.
Almost out of time here. Is there some exciting new research that you're doing right now?
Oh, gosh. There's a lot of really cool things. That this question of 12 minutes a day was sort of the starting point for us, or minimum effective dose. We did many, many studies on that. Now we're looking into seeing how we can train trainers to disseminate it. So how do we get people that know about the particular context, whether it's medical faculty teaching medical students, or we just had published a paper of military spouses teaching other military spouses, teachers teaching students or other teachers. So the scalability of mindfulness with high integrity programs is something we're very excited about, and looking at the real world effects. How does it affect our performance? How does it affect our mood in an ongoing way?
Well, thank you once again for joining us today on Radio Times. Mishi Jha, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she's a professor of psychology at the University of Miami, director of their contemplative neuroscience department. And she's got a new book we've been talking about called Peak Mind: Find Your Focus, Own Your Attention, Invest 12 Minutes a Day. To replay this hour and many more, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us at WHYY Radio Times on Instagram and Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.